If the Senate writes a bill in secret and there is nobody there to read it, are they even writing it? Think about it, people. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Monday today, the 19th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is a certain metaphysical quality to our lead story today about the health care bill that we hear the Senate is working on. I say we hear they're working on it because there is, as yet, no public draft of the thing, no hearing scheduled, no nothing, just senatorial assurances. So those in Washington whose business is legislation, that is, lobbyists and interest groups, face a conundrum. How can you have a seat at the table to weigh in on a bill affecting almost 20% of the American economy when, by all appearances, there is no table at which to have a seat? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Dick Woodruff does a lot of lobbying on Capitol Hill for the American Cancer Society.
Normally, when the Senate is doing a big bill, they'll have hearings. We are often asked to bring in our experts or our meeting with committee staff. None of that's really taking place at this point.
The best a lot of health advocacy groups have gotten in terms of access is meetings with low-level staff who don't really know what's going on. The American Heart Association has had the same experience.
We've really tried to play a constructive role in this process, and we feel like, frankly, most times we're talking to the wall.
Sue Nelson does advocacy for the American Heart Association. Now, to some extent, it's normal for some groups who aren't tight with whomever's in power to feel a little left out of the legislative process. But this level of secrecy is different. Paul Pearson, professor of political science at UC Berkeley.
I'm not even sure the Patriot Act was as hidden as this, but for what you would consider normal legislation, there's never been anything like this for major legislation.
So a lot of groups are basing what they know on the bill that passed the House and taking their concerns directly to voters. Again, the American Heart Association, Sue Nelson.
To make certain that their constituents and our patients know what the impact of the bill will be on their lives.
The AARP and American Cancer Society have gone in on ad campaigns either opposing the bill or calling for protection of pre-existing conditions and keeping people covered. A Quinnipiac poll back in May reported that only 21% of Americans approve of the Republican health care plan. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Here's a quick corporate point of view on the politics of the day, which comes as President Trump meets this afternoon with big tech CEOs, Nadella of Microsoft, Cook of Apple, to name just a couple. Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg is probably having a better time. He's over in France at the Paris Air Show, and he was asked by our colleagues at the BBC about all those visits that CEOs are making to the White House.
And I think what we see with President Trump and with the new administration is that business really has a voice, and that as things are being decided around public policy, things like tax reform, trade policy, regulatory reform, things we can do to grow manufacturing jobs, we have a seat at the table. I think that's very productive.
Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg there speaking from Paris to our colleagues at the BBC. Elsewhere in Europe today, British and European negotiators met to start talking about how they are going to talk about Brexit, how those negotiations are going to go. Those meetings, though, have faded into the backdrop of another apparent terrorist attack in London, the fourth in recent weeks in that country. We got Stephen Beard on the line from London to check in on Brexit and the Brits. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
It has been a rough month or so over there. What's the mood is the question.
Pretty grim. Prime Minister May's authority has been shattered, and that's not an exaggeration. I mean, not just as a result of her losing her overall majority in Parliament as a result of the election, which was obviously bad enough, she's now really been buffeted on all sides. She's received a terrific drubbing over her response to this terrible fire in the tower block. She was very widely criticised for not going down to the site straight away and not meeting the survivors. She seems to be a very unlucky politician right now, unable to do anything right.
Is it possible that now with her on the ropes, the Europeans, just to get to the hard Brexit, soft Brexit question, is it possible that the Europeans are going to say, we've got you right where we want you and here are your terms?
Yes, I mean, I think the overwhelming mood in Europe is they are dumbfounded as the Brits by the scale of May's descent from hero to zero. But they do seem to scent the possibility not just of securing a softer Brexit, but possibly of a no Brexit, which would be very good news for them, since Britain makes a net contribution to the EU budget of some $13 billion a year, and the big net contributors like Germany, France, and so on do not want to pick up the shortfall when the Brits leave. But we've had the new French president, Macron, the German finance minister, and the European Commission in recent days all saying, the door is open. You know, Britain doesn't have to leave. Brexit is not a fait accompli. There's still time to reconsider.
Well, do you think, though, if I went to, or you, since you're there, if you went out to a pub or a fish and chips place or something and said, listen, if you had it to do it over again, how would you vote on Brexit? Do you think the people's minds have been changed?
It's very difficult to get the sense of what people are feeling now. I mean, there has been at least one opinion poll which does suggest a change of mind by voters. 53% said they were in favour of a second referendum on EU membership, and 69% said they were against leaving the customs union. Well, that would mean that Britain would not be able to negotiate its own trade deals, one of the main selling points of Brexit. But it's an opinion poll, and we all distrust opinion polls now, don't we? The polls have been all over the place.
They have on everything, but it's worth pointing out here that 53% in favor of a new referendum is more than the exit vote got a year ago.
This is absolutely the point. So, but it is one poll, and you know, those are the opinion polls during the election campaign in aggregate said that Theresa May would get a large overall majority. Mm-hmm. So we know what happened to that prediction.
Stephen Beard in London for us as those Brexit talks about talking begin. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
On Wall Street this Monday, up a lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jay-Z's got a lot going on. He was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame last week, the first rapper so honored. We learned over the weekend that his wife, Beyoncé, of course a music industry force in her own right, has given birth to their twins. And he's got a new album dropping next week. You can get it if you subscribe to Tidal, the streaming service that he started with Madonna and Kanye West and a bunch of other artists, or if you have Sprint, which bought a 30% stake in Tidal back in January. That kind of exclusivity, though, has had a mixed run in the streaming world. Marketplace's Rima Kreis looks at the limits of limits.
Here's a taste of Jay-Z's new album called 444.
Letter to my dad that I never wrote.
It's from a 30-second video clip that ends with this message in all caps. Switch to Sprint and get 6 months of Tidal on us.
That seems like an insane value proposition to me.
George Howard teaches music business at Berklee College of Music. He says most people are not going to switch to the country's number four carrier for a Jay-Z album.
You're just going to go find some other way to get the album, through piracy. You're not going to jump through these ridiculous hoops.
That's why Sprint is dangling a six-month free trial. Aram Sinrake is a communications professor at American University. He says the company's betting that when it's time to pay, customers will be hooked on Tidal and Sprint.
How many consumers look at their cable bill and say, oh, what's that $11 charge? What's that $4.93 charge?
And he says for Tidal, which was once on death watch, bundling could help. He says streaming is a business
with very, very razor-thin margins. And the only way that that it can really be profitable is if it's becomes part of a larger enterprise.
Tidal still only has about 3 million subscribers compared to Spotify's 50 million and Apple's 27. And exclusivity can have its drawbacks over time. Ted Cohen is a managing partner of Tag Strategic, a digital entertainment consulting firm.
I think it's, you know, worked very well for his wife, for Beyoncé. It's a very successful digital stunt.
But even Beyoncé, like lots of artists who start out exclusive, eventually become less exclusive. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
A story now about the economic devil you know versus the devil you don't. Morro Bay is about halfway up the California coast between L.A. and San Francisco. Commercial fishing has been its economic backbone basically forever, but overfishing and what nets can do to dolphins and sea turtles that boat captains don't mean to catch has led to a raft of rules that are complicated and expensive to comply with. Those rules have kept a lot of local boats docked, but one green-minded group up there is helping to get them back in the water. Marketplace's Andy Euler took a road trip.
A 57-foot boat carrying 50,000 pounds of squid, wiggling in purplish, just docked at Morro Bay. Bob Meharry watches on the sidelines. He's fished here for 42 years and likes to see a local boat doing well.
Because when you fill the boat up or you make a right move or you hand a kid a big paycheck for the week and he thanks you, there's a lot of satisfaction in that.
Meharry says full boats have been a rare sight. The late 90s brought strict federal catch limits on West Coast ground fish like cod, halibut, and flounder, some of the more popular fish to catch and sell. Some fishermen sold their boats. Others left for new ports. Meharry stuck it out, going after different fish.
It is what it is. If you're going to survive in the fishing business, you have to be able to adapt.
Some Morro Bay fishermen have adapted to something else, a surprising partner, the Nature Conservancy. The powerful nonprofit is known for buying up land to protect it from development. Michael Bell directs the Oceans Program for the group in California. He says at first, the strategy was to buy about half of the area's lucrative and limited fishing licenses.
There were some within the Nature Conservancy that thought these permits should just go on the shelf, and then that would be a conservation outcome, less fishing.
The goal was to limit trawling, a destructive way to fish where weighted nets drag the ocean floor. But then TNC came to understand that even if local boats were sidelined, other bigger ones from elsewhere could just come in and trawl. Better to improve practices at the local level.
If you're going to change fishing, there needs to be incentives. And the incentives available to us are really market incentives.
Make it worth it to fish sustainably. The Nature Conservancy took a totally different approach. They partnered with fishermen instead of blocking them. Now think about that. The people telling you you're ruining the ocean all of a sudden want to support you. It's not an easy sell. TNC met with fishermen and local politicians. It even established a separate nonprofit to redistribute the fishing licenses it had bought, the Morro Bay Community Quota Fund. Eventually, fishermen signed on, like Bill Blue.
I've been in Morro Bay since 1974.
We met on his 45-foot boat, the FV Britta Michelle. The Britta Michelle is well-equipped to catch ground fish, but Blue needed a license. The easiest way was through the quota fund, even though it meant an interview with a board of fishing experts. That made him nervous.
Oh, yeah. I was skeptical at first, and I think that, you know, it was a learning process on both sides. They never made promises that they didn't keep, but they made assumptions.
Assumptions like 60- and 70-year-old fishermen being open to reporting their catch online and bring iPads on board for it. But he did it. He now uses an app called eCatch. Dwayne Oberhoff is executive director of the Fishing Collective. He uses the eCatch data to track fish populations in Morro Bay and to track the fishermen's earnings.
Since 2006 until today, there's been about almost 6 million pounds of fish landed worth at the dock to the fishermen that have landed it about $8.1 million.
A sustainable fishermen's collective is something of an oxymoron. Much of the profession's appeal is being alone on a boat, minding your own business. But Oberhoff and his colleagues see bigger investor-backed boats with more destructive nets taking over West Coast fishing. Banding the little guys together is their best bet for both a healthy ocean and local economy. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Our employers know that this is the population they need to blend into their workforce if they're going to continue to grow.
Grow or die, right? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 144 points today, 0.6%, 21,528. NASDAQ up 87 points, about 1.4%, 62.39. The S&P 500 up 20 points, 24.53 there. Snapchat is getting a $100 million investment lifeline from Time Warner. Under the partnership, Time Warner's going to produce original shows and advertise Snapchat in its app in a quest for younger viewers. On the news, Snap up 0.2%. Today, Sprint isn't wasting any time. Using Jay-Z's new album we were telling you about, Sprint up 1.6%. Today, bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.19%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Ryssdal. Marketplace is in the final week of fundraising before our books close for the year. We're asking you to step up and help support us today so that we can continue the in-depth, independent economic coverage you rely on. Any amount, even a small donation every month, counts. We appreciate your support. So please give today at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's another busy week on Capitol Hill. Paul Ryan's making a speech on tax reform. There's a hearing on use of military force in Syria. And over in the Senate, the clock is ticking on getting the so far still secret Republican health care bill done by the 4th of July recess. But Max Ehrenfreund points out in the Washington Post, there are fewer staffers both in Congress and in the research agencies that support Congress, helping lawmakers get done all the work that there is to do. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
What does it mean when Congress is as busy as it is this year, and it has, as you say in this piece, so many fewer people doing the staff work than it used to?
Essentially, what it means is that ordinary lawmakers are pressed for time, and often they find themselves out of their depth, no matter how smart they are or how experienced they are. It takes a lot of work to make a law. And, you know, the concern is that this could result at some point in a reduction in the quality of the law.
One of the things you point out is that while rank-and-file members are seeing their staff allowances, right, because they all get salary allowances in the budget process, that rank-and-file members are seeing those allowances shrink. The leadership, Senator McConnell, they are seeing an expansion in their staffs.
That's right. If you look over the past 30 years or so, the leadership staff has increased by about 50%, give or take. And that is especially a result of changes made by former Speaker Newt Gingrich. And he took actions that really increased the power of the leadership. He also reduced the other organizations that are affiliated with Congress and part of the whole legislative enterprise, such as the Congressional Budget Office, the Government Accountability Office, which is, of course, the well-known watchdog, and other bodies and entities that provided rank-and-file lawmakers, particularly in the House, with a sense of, you know, what's really going on.
You say in this piece someplace that the primary reason people leave, one of the primary reasons, is that they want better pay. And I guess the question that comes out of that is, who is doing the leaving? It's not the young ones right out of college, right, who are having a great time working on Capitol Hill. It's the mid-grade and the more experienced staffers who are taking off.
So that's a concern for lawmakers. You know, they notice that it just seems like once people really start to figure out how the place works and what they're doing and everything, that's when they feel like it's time to start a family or get a place of their own, you know, move out of the city. Hmm. And so oftentimes, you know, they leave Congress for places where they can make more money.
Does this then necessarily, the decline in staffing levels, does that necessarily give lobbyists and outside groups more power?
It often does. I mean, if you think about it, you know, you might be working in the House and you might be a junior member of the staff and you're used to asking your boss basic questions about how things work or, you know, you just need to figure something out. And then your boss leaves for K Street and joins a lobbying firm because that person can make more money there. Then, you know, you're more likely to call a lobbyist for help.
If they didn't know about it before or if they weren't willing to talk about it, certainly now that it's been in the pages of The Washington Post, it's more of an open secret on Capitol Hill. Any sense that this is going to change anytime soon?
That is a very interesting question. And I think the process involving the health care bill in the Senate right now is going to be a great experiment to see, you know, where lawmakers draw the line, because McConnell, the majority leader, the Republican leader in the Senate, he is holding all the cards. That is a concern, I think, for many people. Many Republicans would like to have a sense of what their party is planning to do on health care. On the other hand, there can be an advantage to doing it this way if you are operating in a highly charged political environment, and if you're, you know, if your main focus is on getting a bill through, then, you know, you might try to concentrate control and maintain a very strict hold on what's going on. And that's what the concentrating power in the leadership has done for Congress.
Max Ehrenfreund, he writes for The Washington Post. Max, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
While the courts sort out President Trump's travel ban and the State Department says refugee resettlement numbers in this country continue to decline, there is still the small matter of people who are already here. Refugees, some of them. Migrants, other under conditions. Most of them, though, having to start off from essentially scratch once they get here. Somalia is one of the six Muslim-majority countries included in the travel ban, and the biggest concentration of Somalis in the United States is in Minnesota, not just in Minneapolis-St. Paul, but out in more rural parts of that state as well, where integrating them into life and into the economy has been tough. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
A four-week class, open to anyone, wrapped up recently at a Catholic college in central Minnesota. It was called Somali Lives and Culture, and it drew about 40 people.
Huda, could you talk a little bit more about Sharia?
We said Sharia is an Arabic word that literally means a path.
The teacher, Huda Ibrahim, is a Somali-born college instructor and author. Her book, From Somalia to Snow, served as the course material. Ibrahim's tall, wears glasses, a chunky gold necklace, and a head covering, as many Muslim women do. She gets a lot of questions about it.
I mean, seriously, this girl was telling me, do you shower that with that thing? What? No, we don't shower with that thing.
Her head covering has also drawn harsher comments.
Someone said to me once, why are you covered? You shouldn't be wearing that, and or you should go back to Somalia, you know, right? So I would say, with all due respect, you know, I came here when I was 19. I went to school here. I make sure that I speak the language. You know, I have a job. I obey the law. I pay taxes. You know, what else do you really want me to do?
When Ibrahim moved to St. Cloud a decade ago to be near her brothers, she says there were only a few Somali families around. But those became magnets for others. And there was work in the poultry processing and manufacturing plants in and around St. Cloud. The town was once nicknamed White Cloud because it had hardly any diversity. Today, stroll around the lake in the middle of town and you'll hear many families speaking East African languages. Integration has been difficult at times. Somali kids have walked out of school over bullying. Last year, someone wrapped pig intestines around the doorknob of a local halal grocery store. Muslims don't eat pork. And when a Somali-born man stabbed people at the town's main shopping mall last year, that increased calls to restrict refugees.
There's a lot of suspicion because they're Muslims, and we have no idea what that means.
Vincent DeVargas wants to change that. He helped organize the Somali Lives and Culture class.
We don't have to become like them. They don't have to become like us. But we have to enjoy the fact that they enrich our lives.
There are economic reasons for embracing the refugees, according to Gail Cruikshank. She connects job seekers and employers through the Greater St. Cloud Talent Development Corporation.
In the St. Cloud area, the growth for us is strictly coming from our immigrant population.
Cruikshank helps employers who hire refugee workers. Things like how to deal with language barriers, how to accommodate prayer breaks on a production line. Somali workers' median household income in the state is low, in the range of $20,000 a year. Few have bachelor's degrees. But some economists say they're doing low-skill work employers need.
Our employers know that this is the population they need to blend into their workforce if they're going to continue to grow.
Huda Ibrahim also works with employers on these issues through a consulting business she founded. Her business partner, Abdi Mahad, says it's not just about white St. Cloud folks learning about Somalis.
If you go to Somali restaurant, any restaurant in the city, they don't have a menu at all.
Mahad says the Somali business owners need to make an effort too.
So someone who is not Somali, you know, ordering food is not something easy because you don't know what kind of food you want to order. You don't know ingredient, you know, now we are working on that.
Mahad and Huda Ibrahim say integration means accommodation on both sides. In St. Cloud, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, in which Amazon is terrible, yes, but you do kind of have to hand it to founder and CEO Jeff Bezos. I read in the pages of the Bezos-owned Washington Post over the weekend that Amazon has a patent on a system that would prevent you while you're in one of its physical stores. And remember, Amazon just bought 450 or so Whole Foods physical stores. It would prevent you from using your smartphone to check other retailers to see if they've got cheaper prices. Dastardly, right? Right, but at least the Post ran the piece, yeah? Was that an elephant? I think it was an elephant. Dow up 144 points today, 0.6%. NASDAQ up 87 points, about 1.4%. S&P 500 up 20 points, 24.53 at the close. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.